Well, let's get right to it. Inside Ivy Hoops, it's been a while. Welcome to the Ivy Hoops Online podcast. This is IHO editor Mike Tony, joined by IHO writer extraordinaire Rob Brown. And Rob, has anything happened in the past month or so that we could talk about? Have we scraped the barrel here? And has anything happened recently?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably our latest season recap, but it's all for amazing news, both on the men and women's side, right? So I guess, you know, we should just start with the Princeton Tigers, start with the men, and then we can transition into the women and Columbia as well. So whatever you want to lead us off, we'll go.
Well, we're later because we've had a postseason to remember, that's for sure. Mainly for the orange and black faithful among us in the Ivy Hoops world. But really, it's something that hopefully we can all celebrate. I did notice, I would say the majority, at least in the web sphere, of Penn fans, kind of got on board with the Princeton run, particularly the men's side, as they got to soak up the well-deserved Sweet 16 attention. Of course, Rob and I are both Penn grads, but I don't think either of us, begrudged a Princeton run to Sweet 16 glory on the men's side. And yeah, if you're listening to this podcast, you know what happened. Princeton going on the Ivy League's only their second Sweet 16 run in the modern era, dating back to 1985 for the NCAA tournament. Matched only by Cornell in 2010, and it's really extraordinary that this was the team to do it, because quite frankly we've had more, we've had a lot more dominant Ivy champions even in recent years, and certainly throughout the modern NCAA tournament era. This was a team that, blew that lead in epic proportion against Yale, lost to Dartmouth, lost four Ivy games, was not the number one seed in Ivy Madness, relying on underclassmen in key positions throughout the year and going into games against much more experienced and certainly larger teams in the NCAA tournament, and just straight up imposing its will on the boards and inside against Missouri, Arizona. These are games that the kind of games that last a lifetime. Any thoughts looking back on that run the Princeton men made through this NCAA tournament, full of upsets and making some noise that reverberated throughout the country?
Yeah, I think you pointed out about other teams in the conference other years, but I think also, an argument could be made that last year's Princeton team, which was the Ivy League champs and entered the tournament at Harvard, the number one seed, was probably a stronger team top to bottom. Sure. But they didn't make it through. This team did. I think that that game against Yale, where they lost that lead, was a real wake-up call, really important for them. Obviously, they could, you saw the turnaround the following, week against Penn to finish the regular season. When they went into the conference tournament, I think Yale came, when you watched it from the inside, Yale was the most confident, I think, at least outwardly confident of the four teams there, and they had such success at Jadwin that I think, you know, that they were the big pick. But Princeton really was very disciplined through that tournament, and you could see it transfer into the NCAA. They did a fabulous job. I thought they did it against 10 both times, Yale and then into Arizona, really limiting the fouls, preventing the other team from getting to the foul line. And I know that really frustrated Arizona. Their coach kept talking about, you know, this is a really physical game, but they're not calling the fouls. And it's like, yeah, they're not calling them because that's how Princeton plays. That wasn't a surprise to anyone who's watched that team. And I think when you have a starting center like Tosin Owomon, you are in every game. I mean, you know, Mitch Henderson talked about it 2 years ago or last year's tournament that this is the best passing big man you're going to see or you have seen in the Ivy League in about 25 years. This year, I think he upped it to 50 years, but, you know, that's all, you know, understandable. He is a unique talent with what he can do in all facets of his game. And I think that really surprised teams that are not familiar with Princeton or the Ivy League, which I think somewhat surprised me about Missouri because early in the season, Penn played them on the road and almost beat them. So you would have thought that Missouri would have done a better scouting job. But whether they did or didn't, Princeton stuck to their game plan and controlled that game from the opening tip. I think, you know, it was wonderful to see, and it's great that the whole country got behind them. And as you said, I think, you know, almost everybody in the league, no matter where your allegiance was originally, you know, got on board with that run. It's wonderful when people outside the conference can see, you know, the high-quality players, coaches, you know, it's really great. But for those of us that follow it in, you know, game in and game out, you know, we wish that people had that kind of a spotlight on the league, you know, from November on, instead of just, you know, thinking about it for about 10 days in March. But all in all, a wonderful, you know, ending of the season. And, you know, I think that's going to really translate into a phenomenal 2024, but we can get into that in a little bit.
Well, I think it's interesting that the run came when it did. First of all, it comes on the heels of much hand-wringing over, you know, how is canceling a season going to hurt the Ivy League? And, you know, there was a lot of concern that when the Ivy League was the only Division I conference to cancel an entire season out of precaution during the pandemic, no 2021 season, that, you know, what would that mean? You know, what kind of drop-off would there be? And I think it's clear that the quality of the league is on the rise, and that the league hasn't suffered, at least to date, for prioritizing public health over competitive sport and being alone in doing that. You know, that was, and it's good to see, it was good to see that acknowledged, you know, during this run, that, you know, on the men's side, certainly the Sweet 16 run, you know, validates the strength of the league, as does the fact that, you know, if you looked at the KenPom rating for the league throughout the year, you know, taking a look at where the middle of the pack, where the middle of the conference lies, you know, there's more parity. You know, the so-called lower echelon or the, you know, bottom dwellers aren't really dwelling quite so low anymore. It's you know, it was a better league this year, and the payoff came through with Princeton coming out on top. And on the women's side, really there should have been a hashtag two-bit Ivy. And the fact that there was an Ivy League tournament turned out to be to the detriment of the league with Columbia bowing out quickly, NCAA selection committee citing that as the reason why they didn't get in, because they couldn't take care of business against a very scrappy, underrated Harvard squad that they eventually did get revenge over a short time later. But the point is, this was a strong season, and coming so soon after the pandemic layoff, I think validates, or at least can be argued, validates what the league did and how they did it.
I think you're right. If you think about the men's side, they were the 16th ranked conference at the end of 2020, heading into the pandemic. And now, just a couple of years later, they finished the season 12th in the nation. So that's a pretty big jump, honestly. And the women's conference, they're number 7. They're the number 7 ranked conference in the country. So you can see top to bottom strength, which is never, to an unprecedented level in both groups. I think, if you look at the men's side, of course you had Brown battling Cornell, to the very last game. Dartmouth had, one of its better seasons, really sticking into the Ivy Madness race till late in the game, late in the season. Harvard, another injury-laden season for Harvard, 2 in a row. I know that the injuries have been there for many years, but the second year in a row without them making Ivy Madness. But, a full-strength Harvard team is going to be, better than 14-14 and 5-9 in the conference. So this was a very strong year, and it had the potential to be even better if it wasn't for injuries. But I think, you pointed out in one of your articles about the Princeton run, just that idea of longevity with the coaches. The players know who they're going to get when they're recruited. They know their coaches are going to stay. The coaches have the ability to kind of ride things out and learn the ropes and, make their mistakes and build upon it. And I think also, you have a lot of athletes that are the grad transfer is another discussion that we can certainly have, but, you have players playing out through their senior year. So you have mature players who are used to a school, used to a system, coaches that have experience. And I think you're seeing that pay off. People can argue that the Ivy League certainly has a lot of strict rules in place, and they do. But, the positive side is you've got mature players and mature coaches, and you're seeing the fruits of that situation play out.
Right. Well, you anticipated where I was going to go next, which is, the longevity point. Yeah, I mean, it also comes, who made the run? Mitch Henderson, who really in his first few years got a lot of flack for upper echelon finishes, not getting over the top pre Ivy League tournament when finishing in the top half of the league really didn't count for anything if you didn't finish first. It wasn't until his sixth season that they went on their undefeated run to an Ivy League championship and NCAA tournament appearance, and then it was another 6 years until the second one. So there's a case to be made there for patience, and that's something that the entire Ivy League can find some hope in, or some consolation, because there hasn't been any movement in a long time. You have to go back to 2016 for the last time there were any men's coaching changes, and remarkable. If you think about it, not a single program has had a head coaching change in seven years. We'll be going on 8, in the entire Ivy League tournament era since the 2016-17 season. It's just remarkable, and when you do get that kind of longevity, you would hope that the league benefits that you know that there isn't that turnover that programs are having to deal with, and I think you are seeing the middle of the league kind of rise because of that, and it's good. It is good for the league. It's good for the league to have a Brian Earl in tow and James Jones to be sticking around, and you know, as much as Penn fans, some, at least a few, some may not want it, may be getting a little tired and restless at this point. You know, you do have a coach in Steve Donohue who's won 4 Ivy League championships, and is at least been consistent in getting Penn into the Ivy League tournament every year. Now that counts for a little bit more than it did in the first half of Mitch Henderson's run at Princeton. So there's something to be said there for longevity, and you know, it's the opposite of a vicious cycle. It's been a good cycle with the league getting better because the coaches are sticking around, and maybe they're sticking around because the league's getting better. It's good stuff. One of the best games, I think, in really Ivy history, when you think about what the stakes were and just the thrill factor of the game, was the Princeton women's NCAA tournament win as a 10 seed over 7 seeded NC State. Just a tremendous tremendous performance and really clutch play coming out on top, and a late fourth quarter defensive clampdown helping Princeton eke that one out, and a shot that Tiger fans will remember for all time in that game. A go ahead 3-pointer with Grace Stone getting that steal and delivering the victory with that three to pull out the win in Salt Lake City. What were your thoughts on how the women's on Princeton's run, to secure another Ivy League tournament title and getting that win, and where their program is at this point, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, an interesting year for them. I believe they started off ranked, within the top 25. They ran into a buzzsaw that was Villanova early on, and Matty Sechrist, who was the number 3 pick in yesterday's draft, the WNBA. But they certainly, they started off the season, they had a strong non-conference season. They really challenged themselves, one of the hardest non-conference schedules in the country. But then they started off 0-2 in league play. They lost at Harvard, and then they lost, I believe they lost to Columbia, right, the following Friday evening in overtime at home. So this was uncharted territory for them over the last number of several years. And, it kind of looked like Columbia had a chance to kind of put their foot down and really, take control of the conference. But Princeton, just like the men, which happened later in the year, but for the women, it happened, in January, that they regrouped, figured out their identity or remembered their identity, and really just plowed through the rest of the schedule. Getting back to those amazing defensive fundamentals. The interesting part was Columbia. Certainly they started off strong. They, as we've noted, many times throughout our articles and conversations, that this was a revenge tour year for them. They took care of Stony Brook and Seton Hall and UMass and Princeton, you know, a number of teams that beat them last year. And they looked like they were on their way, but just the night after the Princeton victory, they you know, had a slip up at the Palestra against Penn. They then had a nationally televised game against Princeton at home. That one didn't go their way. But with all that said, they were tied with Princeton and still held the net tiebreaker. Unfortunately, the last game of the season, they did win against number 7 ranked Cornell, but they needed to go to overtime. One of the problems, as you alluded to with the two-bid Ivy conversation, the NCAA committee did not do their homework. Yes, Columbia struggled in that last game, but one of their starters, Hannah Pratt, was out with an injury. So, you know, they weren't at full strength in that game. They dropped them several points or positions down. Princeton ended up getting the higher seed. It didn't affect the matchups pretty much no matter what. It was going to be Columbia-Harvard in the semifinal and Princeton-Penn in the other one. But I think it kind of shook them a little bit. And that game again in at Jadwin with Princeton, Harvard and Columbia was just, I mean, you know, you talk about like how good the North Carolina State-Princeton game was. The Harvard-Columbia game was phenomenal, super exciting, you know, the whole way through. The Columbia fans, which really turned out, you know, in droves throughout the whole season. I mean, I don't think men and women, I don't know if there's a better fan base than the Columbia women's team. They showed up, they packed Jadwin, super enthusiastic atmosphere, and Harvard, to their credit, withstood, you know, Columbia's challenge, took every shot that they had, and came out on top. Unfortunately, that was, you know, that's the problem, is Columbia, that was just enough for the NCAA committee to drop the Lions, and they were the first team left out of the tournament. The explanation that Columbia was given was, you lost your semifinal. Unfortunately, you know, when you're a mid-major and you don't have the national reputation that Princeton has, your margin for error is super small. You know it, I know it, the difficulties of a good mid-major trying to schedule a strong conference is really hard. High major teams do not want to play a mid-major that they're going to lose or have a chance of losing to. So Columbia does what they were told after last season. They get a stronger schedule. They get an NET ranking in the 40s by the end of the season. And then it turns out that a couple points in overtime against a Harvard team that ended up, like, you know, somewhere in the you know, top 50 or just outside the top 50 in the NET, that's pretty unfair. So I do, you know, take issue with that, with what the NCAA did. Obviously, Princeton, they were a 10 seed. Even with that, they're probably underseeded, you know, given the talent on that roster. I don't think NC State took them lightly, you know, compared to what, you know, maybe an Arizona or Missouri did on the men's side. I just think it was strength against strength and two evenly matched teams, and Princeton came out with that buzzer beater at the end. Should not be a shock to anybody in the nation. Carla Berube now has led the team to two first-round quote-unquote upsets. Not a surprise to anybody that's been following the team and the league the last several years. Going up against Utah at home, that's a tall order, just like they had to go up against Indiana, you know, at home last year. They gave it a really good effort. They came up just short, but certainly if it was a neutral site, you know, maybe things play out differently. But that's the nature of the women's tournament, at least for now. That's how they play their opening round. So, you know, Princeton's got to hope for a chance at getting a neutral site in one of those second round games. Columbia, you know, I we have to talk about them. They were devastated after that loss against Harvard. You could just see it in the coach, Coach Griffith, when she gave her press conference. She was trying to lobby the committee. It just didn't work out. They were still a little bit shocked a few days later, but they turned it around very quickly, and they had a really impressive WNIT run, which led them to the finals at Kansas last Saturday night. came up short again, you know, just short against a really tall and athletic Big 12 team. You know, a couple shots just didn't go their way. If they did, you know, maybe Columbia's having a parade instead of the Jayhawks. But it was really, really a testament to that team's resilience, the talent on their roster, the talent in the coaching staff, that they really put it together and had a fabulous run. First appearance in the NIT, WNIT final for any Ivy League school, first Final Four appearance. They and Harvard, you know, also both made it to the Great Eight, where they had an unprecedented fourth matchup with each other. That was kind of amazing to witness. So an amazing season for Columbia, even though it wasn't the way they had planned it out in September and October, but, you know, still a wonderful historic season for them, co-champions of the Ivies. Harvard, their first year under Kari Moore, former Princeton assistant under Courtney Banghart, former Michigan assistant. She, you know, taking over for Kathy Delaney Smith, someone with a 40-plus year history at Harvard, is not an easy task. But she had a great roster, and she, you know, added to that with some great new talent. They just had a good season, and then they just took it to another gear once March turned, into the calendar turned to March. They made it to the Great Eight, you know, best. WNIT run for the Crimson. You know, they've got Harmony Turner coming back. They've got Lola Mullaney coming back, Elena Rodriguez. When you look ahead to 2024, you have got three teams that are really going to battle it out for first place. The rest of the league, as we talked about with the men, strong top to bottom. Like Columbia on the men's side, Dartmouth is not the strongest on the women's side, but, you know, when you're looking at the rest of the conference, a lot of tough teams in there. One thing that I did hear, you know, from the coach, from the Columbia coach at the end of the season press conference, and several times throughout the season, both of these leagues, men and women, you know, if you're looking for that two-bid Ivy, the scheduling has to improve from top to bottom. You know, the women being ranked number 7 in the nation isn't still strong enough to get two bids. So, you know, they've got to be able it's a really hard task, to be sure, but they've got to be able to schedule from the number 1 team to the number 8 team. They've got to be able to schedule stronger non-conference, and hopefully that will go forward in the next couple years. Hopefully the league will also get behind them, both from the scheduling standpoint and also the lobbying standpoint. That's something that, you know, we heard also that the league needed to get a little bit stronger in their support when they go into these committee rooms. So, you know, that's kind of my take on the women's side, and then, you know, some little extra, you know, heading into next year.
Well, it doesn't make sense that a team or a conference that ranks perennially in the top 10, as the Ivy League does in strength, can never get, and has only once gotten two teams in the NCAA tournament, and that was 6 years ago now, or excuse me, 7 years ago now. So, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, and it takes two to tango when it comes to scheduling. You know, that unfortunately isn't something that is entirely in the Ivy League's control. You know, you can only go where the opportunities are, and as you noted, that wasn't the problem for Columbia this time, and probably won't be going forward, given how the program schedules under Megan Griffith. But you know, unfortunately, you know, you can't always pick your spots, and you know, we'll have to see what happens. But yeah,
I think one of the things that I think you noted it in one of your tweets is that they're heading out to the Baja Mar Hoops Championship in in the Bahamas for Thanksgiving, you know, of next season. That's where you're going to see a lot of high major teams. And I think Coach Griffith pointed out that Harvard went to Cancun or went to a tournament in Cancun at Thanksgiving. And, yeah, you're going to be playing some high major teams. And that may be one of those avenues of trying to find your way into these tournaments. You're going to take your lumps, you know, quite possibly, but it's going to, you know, build the quality of the team. It's certainly there's always the chance for an upset, but her point, I think, is that it really builds the strength of a program and it builds the profile of a program to be a part of those. So that could be one of those ways. I'm sure the NCAA has rules on how often you can be a part of those tournaments, but those could be avenues to try and find some stronger opponents.
Yeah, that's really the blueprint, is getting into those tournaments early in the season with other non-conference foes, and just showing what you can do. Since seeing what you can do, it's sometimes it can be a bit of a crapshoot if you've got a player that's injured, or maybe you're just kind of filling your way early on in a season, and it's not indicative or representative of where you are in March. But hey, you just gotta seize the opportunities where they are, and that's definitely a good one for Columbia. It's one to look forward to, that's for sure. And speaking of non-conference tournaments, the buzz today is the reboot of the Big Five that is no longer really the Big Five. If we do simple math, I'll be calling it the City Six, because that's what it is. It's not the Big Five. You know, the Big Ten hasn't been the Big Ten in a long time either, and numbers really don't mean anything anymore in NCAA speak. Neither does geography for most conferences. When you've got USC and Texas and all these conferences going. And all these teams going to different conferences. I've heard buzz of Gonzaga joining the Big East.
Wow! Oh my God!
does that make any sense geographically?
Oh gosh! Get
Spokane and Providence, right next to each other, right? the Big Five announcement today. The Big Five officially welcoming Drexel and unveiling details of a new series format where the Big Five champion or the City Six champion in reality will be determined during a Big Five same day triple header at the Wells Fargo Center, not the Palestra, on December 2nd this year. The announcement being made today at the Wells Fargo Center with sort of a stamp of approval from Fran Dunphy, which is always helpful to have. But how it'll work is the six schools will be separated into three-team pods. One pod will be Temple, LaSalle, and Drexel. The other will be Penn, joined by Villanova and St. Joseph's. And each team will play the other two teams from their pod at their individual on-campus arenas. And then, all teams will participate in a triple header December 2nd, with the first seed in each pod competing for the Big Five title, and the second place teams competing for second place, and the third seeds competing for third place in the Big Five slash City Six slash, you know, whatever this grouping is that we're going to call now. But what do you think of that, of the setup and the venue and just hitting the reset button on?
I think, you know, it's pretty obvious that the Big Five has lost a lot of its luster over the years. It's several decades in the making, that this situation. I really appreciate the fact that Drexel's been brought into the group. Makes a lot of sense. It's silly to keep them out all this time. So it's a neat idea. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. You know, if you've got a three-team pod and it's inevitable that you're going to have some teams at 1-1. I don't know how they're going to break the ties. I hope it's not like a soccer situation where it's goal differential. I don't want to see any team running up the score on another in order to, like, you know, increase the number of total points or the point differential. That wouldn't really do well for the camaraderie of the event. So I hope there's a, you know, a nicer way or a more equitable way to break the tie. I think it's a great idea with the triple header, as you talked about a few moments ago. It is not at the Palestra. I would agree with you that it should be. I remember when they tried to redo the Big Five a number of years ago. This probably goes back to the late 80s or early, I think the early 90s, when they used to have double headers at the old Spectrum. It was too big an arena for the games. It was cavernous. It was empty. You know, it just lost a lot of the luster that you would have within the Palestra. So a triple header in an arena that's 88,000 people, you know, that is going to be an amazing day of basketball. You put them in a 20,000 seat arena, you may just have a lot of empty seats, and or, you know, maybe it'll fill for one game and then empty out after the other. So I do think that putting it at the Wells Fargo is a bit of a disappointment and a missed opportunity. But I do think it's certainly worthwhile to do this new plan and see how it goes. But certainly for those of us that love Philadelphia basketball, December 2nd will be a very enjoyable day.
Yeah, and for years, Penn was, you know, kind of gave Drexel short shrift in requiring that the games be at the Palestra, not wanting to play at the DAC, and that's something that under Steve Bilski, you know, that was, I always found that to be disappointing, that you couldn't just walk over there and play them. It's not that hard. It's not that far. In fact, it's the closest. It's the closest matchup you could have in Division One. Walk over. Call it the Battle of 33rd Street. You know, don't shy away from it. Just go over there. I know you have the Palestra, but go over there and, you know, have it be a respectful home and home series, and welcome Drexel into the fold as a City Six school and embrace the City Six. I still think there's a little bit of disrespect in going with the Big Five name, even though it is more of a brand, choosing to stay on as the Big Five, even while having Drexel in, it's a little bit awkward. I think City Six would have been, if you're going to get behind a brand, I think, City Six is already a name. It's not like it's not out there. It's already out there in the ether. So, go with that. And being at the Wells Fargo is off-putting. You know, the press release was issued today with the president and CEO of Spectacor Sports and Entertainment heralding the Wells Fargo Center's the new center being a brand new world class arena with first class amenities and cutting edge technology, and none of the things you think about when you think about big five basketball being this crowded, sweaty, gritty, and not that gritty, but the adjective, not the noun, this gritty atmosphere, not this kind of, high-class, world-class type of deal with the new Wells Fargo Center. There are some missed opportunities there, but at least there's a recognition that hitting the reset button with Drexel on board is a good thing. And, how the pod system shakes out will be interesting. But it is a good opportunity to at least ensure that everybody's playing each other. There is that intercity camaraderie that hopefully is preserved by this new system. And hopefully, everybody has the wherewithal to make adjustments if and when they need to after seeing how this season shakes out. One thing that's frankly a lot more important is a lawsuit filed recently in federal court last month that could reshape Ivy Athletics. Two Brown basketball players, one former, one current, filing the suit in the federal court in the District of Connecticut, alleging that the players received full cost of attendance scholarship offers, got offers from at least one other Division I university, and saying that the Ivy League is by not offering athletic scholarships, they're violating federal antitrust law by price fixing, raising the net price of education that Ivy athletes pay, and suppressing compensation for the athletic services that they give Ivy schools. Of course, this follows the U.S. Supreme Court's 2021 ruling that NCAA restrictions on education-related benefits, was the term that the high court used, for student athletes violate federal antitrust law, going all the way back to the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act. We'll see where that goes. There's long been the notion, the hope, the expectation that if you remove that scholarship limitation, that the Ivy League could really soar and be one of the best conferences in the country. That's something that Megan Griffith told our Richard Kent last month. That certainly is not not an uncommon view. Abby Myers telling Richard at IHO the same thing. Of course comes after she transferred to Maryland and is now a Dallas Wing. Congrats to her, but that's another conversation. But what do you make, Rob, of the where that stands and the Ivy League's potential to you know, maybe as the argument goes, do better by its student athletes by offering scholarships and in turn maybe bettering the conference's standing.
Yeah, I mean, I think because, like, was it last summer, I believe, Alan Cotler, a former Penn player from the 70s, and Bob Litten, both lawyers, wrote an article about this issue for IHO. It's talking about the antitrust issue that the Ivy League exemptions that they've gotten over the years, and this is all with the goal of not just athletic scholarships, but trying to make Ivy League schools give out merit scholarships, athletic scholarships being one of those. These are schools that sit on enormous endowments, and yes, they provide really strong financial aid packages to their students and their student athletes, or students, athletes, and non-athletes, but, you know, they could be doing much more with their resources is one of the arguments from these lawsuits or this lawsuit. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. The league obviously doesn't want to open up the Pandora's box about the scholarships. As far as they're concerned, athletics is an important part of the university experience, but not, you know, like many of these other universities and colleges across the country, not a primary part of the university experience. An interesting thing about the Ivy League in general is they tend to have many more sports than most other Division I programs. Many of these sports are Olympic sports. These are sports that are predominantly white, predominantly affluent. So is this going to be a situation where if they do give scholarships, are they going to be giving scholarships to families that, you know, more families that don't need it, technically, you know, than families that do need it? I guess the goal when you open up this conversation is making sure that you increase the socioeconomic, racial diversity within a school. If it is just going to be used as a way to benefit the predominant groups of the campus, then, you know, it may defeat the purpose. So time will tell how the courts play this out, and if the universities are forced into these scholarships, how will they adapt? They will inevitably adapt, just like they'll adapt to the admissions case in the Supreme Court, and that's going to come out in a few months, the ruling that will come out in a few months. These schools have adapted over decades, so I'm sure they'll find a creative way to deal with this. It could involve who knows how it is? It could be shifting a number of the sports to Division III, where they don't give scholarship, or maybe it puts them at a club level. So this has, for me, this has a lot of ramifications from college admissions, you know, equity, so diversity on campus, and, you know, what is the makeup of an athletic department? You know, could an Ivy League athletic department look like, you know, a couple of years from now? So we'll have to see, but this is I think it's a really huge thing to keep, you know, everyone should be keeping their eye on, you know, athlete and non-athlete alike, especially, you know, again, because the goal is to create merit scholarships across the board. So I think this affects lots of people attending and applying to these universities.
Yeah, it's always hard to predict how, you know, where, how the to whom the benefits will crumble when these tectonic shifts take place. But certainly I wouldn't want to see a shift to scholarships change, make athletics more of a presence than, much more of a presence than they are, as you know, I think you put it well, that they're there to enhance the college experience, but they shouldn't be the primary thing you think of when you think of the school. You know, it's not, you never wanna, you shouldn't have the basketball team or the football team be whatever you think of when you think of any institution of higher learning, I don't think. That's one of the things that I think makes Ivy Hoops what it is the fact that you know, these are students that are also athletes and not just nominally student athletes, as you do come across elsewhere. But you know, on the other hand, yeah, you know, there should be education related benefits, as the Supreme Court put it, that are more readily available, and how you pull that off, who's benefiting, is that are those benefits flowing to families and prospective students who need them, and not you know, not affluent prospective student athletes, as you mentioned. You know, that's got to be the key, and that's an implementation question, and we'll have to see where this all is headed. But it definitely seems to be coming to a head.
Yeah, and even with that, you know, while we're focusing on the scholarship issue, you know, we still have this NIL, name, image, and likeness issue. And, you know, even if the Ivy League is able to give scholarships, there are a lot of schools out there with stronger NIL opportunities for students. So you could be having this argument about scholarships, and then, you know, that same athlete who maybe 5 years ago would have said, thank goodness the Ivy League has scholarships, now they say, well, I'm glad you have scholarships, but these other schools have scholarships, and there are a lot more opportunities for NIL. That's something, again, the Ivy League has a lot more rules in place than any other conference in the country. Is that something that's going to have to be looked at as well? I think there was an article in the Daily Princetonian last week that said Princeton is starting to, you know, explore some, you know, more of a, I don't know what the right word is, but maybe they're looking to get more involved in this, or maybe more supportive of their athletes, and maybe trying to partner with them in some way, shape, or form to improve the NIL opportunities. Because, you know, it's not in this day and age in college athletics, it's no longer just the scholarship. There is a whole other piece to the puzzle that right now the Ivies are not necessarily looking at. You know, they're kind of high, you know, keeping quiet on both areas. But while the courts are dealing with the scholarship, you know, there needs to be some movement or changes, or maybe not. You know, but there needs to be some discussion on NIL compared to other conferences.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time. We had a lot of ground to cover. It's been quite an extraordinary season in the last few weeks here, and I want to publicly congratulate you, Rob, for coming out on top in one of our Ivy pick'em pools. it was good stuff. You came out on top. You beat me by one game, I think.
Yeah, look, men and women both very close. A lot of people pick'em. Bunch. It's just like the Ivy League standings.
That's right. That's right.
Right until the very last game.
That's right, and our own George Clark came on top on the men's pick'em. You came on top, out on top on the women's side, and yeah, it was harder to the records were a little worse this year than usual, just because it was a little, at least on the men's side, was just a little harder to. A little harder to predict how things would shake out, but yeah, when you factor in the last few weeks, Columbia playing into April, an extraordinary run, and the WNIT, Harvard too getting there, and even Penn making it a three team field, not to mention what Princeton did. Yeah, just great stuff on the women's side. Good stuff on the men's side too, with Princeton and You know, Yale doing what it does under James Jones, just always at or near the top of the league. Anything you're looking out for this off season? Anything else you wanna throw in there while you've got the mic?
I mean, just you know, a phenomenal season, a historic season, really, for both groups. And by the end of the year, I'm looking forward to an even more competitive 2024. I think the men's side is going to be bunched. I think you're going to have another season of six or seven teams battling it out. I think on the women's side, you're going to have three teams in the top, and then you're going to have Penn and Yale in that middle group. I think people should keep their eye out for Brown. That is a team that's moving up under Monica LeBlanc. So you could have, you know, five or six teams in that mix for the Ivy Madness run, which will be held at Columbia in the media mecca of the United States here. We'll get everyone into New York City next year. So I'm just kind of looking out for that. I'm crossing my fingers that Jordan Dingell and Abby Sue do not graduate this summer so that they can stay on for their senior years. I know the allure of transferring as a grad transfer to these high majors is very alluring. I think Kayla Padilla noted out in the DP, in the Daily Pennsylvanian, you know, what it's like to be recruited by these teams and the amenities that they have, and not only are you playing high major, you know, schedules, but you also have, like, amazing facilities. I get it, but, you know, I'm expecting, you know, a lot of consistency in our, you know, I guess I'm expecting no surprises on the coaching changes and the player changes as we head into next year, and then just two really great conferences battling it out from whenever, late December, early January until middle March, just like this year. I don't know if we're going to get another Sweet 16 showing. You know, maybe this time it'll happen on the women's side, but I certainly know it's going to be another amazing season. There's always some surprise that happens in the off season, so we'll see what that is. But right now I'm kind of hoping for no drama and just, let's get us ready for October and November.
Well, it's easy to forget we're coming off of the last season. We had still getting emerging or dealing with all these pandemic and COVID related reschedulings in the 21-22 season, and of course the season before that wasn't a season at all. So yeah, there's a lot to be grateful for, a lot to be grateful for, not just the postseason success, but, having some action, to talk about, and, a lot of stuff seems to be, trending either in the right direction or at least hopes for more parity, more equity. That hope is out there. So deeply grateful, I want to say publicly while I've got the mic, deeply grateful for all the expert insight and work you put into the site, Rob, and grateful for all of our fantastic contributors making for another wonderful season of Ivy Hoops coverage. Glad to be able to offer it to you. Thank you for listening, and signing off for now. And stay with us, and thank you for following along.